So the core of what we our main lecture topic today, then, are fundamentals of intellectual property. You're designing stuff, you're generating products. The kind of question inevitably will come up, well, actually, who owns this idea? What's that idea worth? How do we actually protect that? Someone from just stealing our ideas, stealing our design. Okay, so we'll talk about that for today and probably end up getting out of here just a little bit early. So we're going to talk about patent types, the patent process, a couple of example cases, including quick review of U.S. patent reform, although that's a little bit old at this point. And throughout the whole lecture today, we're going to talk about really what's the value of a patent. How is a patent really worth to you or to your company? And then we'll touch briefly on other ways to protect your intellectual property. All right. So the first steps throughout this entire process is to have good documentation of your design process. Right. So you need to document when things start working. You need to have a good lab notebook, effectively. This has become, as we'll see, a little bit less important than it used to be, but it still is a fundamental part of the process and being able to prove, if you have to, that you were the actual inventor, you developed this idea. Okay. You need to know the intellectual property or policy of your company. Okay. So for example, the UL1's listed there, and we'll look at that in just a second. And then there's the UL system, which of course is our parent kind of organization, has its own policy that's an extension, has other cases covered that are not explicitly covered in ours. So if we're talking about research results, anything I do here, right, basically the university owns. And that will be true for most jobs you work in your career. You invent something at that job, that company owns it, right? You have to be listed as an inventor on the patent, but that company owns the intellectual property and licensing, almost always. All right? It's true here. It's true at most universities. So, like I said, university owns it. Okay? For you guys as students, it's a little bit more flexible depending on kind of what you're doing. So this is the whole paragraph. I'll highlight a couple of sentences for you. So if you're a student and not being paid by the university for a research job, you're a pure student, right? You're not working in a lab here. You're developing intellectual property as a student, okay? And making no more than incidental use of university resources, okay? You're just using the classroom, using the lights. That's incidental use. Using machinery downstairs, using the water jet, using the CNC, using any of the manufacturing equipment, using lab resources, right? That's not incidental use anymore, right? So then we come down here. So then at best, you have joint ownership of that intellectual property. You all get to share it, right? Because you've used UL's resources to develop your idea, so they have some right to it, okay? I will note also that as an employee, depending on your company, you have to make sure you know your policy, it may extend even beyond what you do in the confines of your job. So I know for our particular policy here, if I go home and invent some stuff in my apartment, and it's within my area of expertise, I do some robotic stuff in my apartment, UL still owns it. Right? It's within my expertise. Right? If I went off and did some painting or something, talk about copywriting that, intellectual property, that's not within my area of expertise on the job here, I get to keep that. Okay? And that will be true in a lot of places. All right? So you need to know, if you are concerned with intellectual property and are an inventor, make sure you know your company or organization's policy. Okay. Questions about that? Yes, sir.
So if you did want to go and invent something out of robotics, would you have to disaffiliate completely with UL? Like, would you have to quit your job?
Well, I think if I wanted 100% ownership of the intellectual property, very likely so. Most universities, there's a lot here that I think UL has a reason to expect ownership of some of the intellectual property, right? I don't have to pay for the lights, right? They pay my salary. I have access to the water jet and CNC and all that stuff, right? That I would have to come out and pay for if I was trying to do that kind of research on my own, right? So that's that. The other part, I think in most universities, we're getting better at it here. You look at, you know, I went to Georgia Tech. I know there. They have support. They want professors to be inventors. And while they have, if you look at Georgia Tech, for example, I have a patent there from my PhD work. Georgia Tech owns that patent, but they have a fee structure and revenue structure where if they're licensing it, a good chunk of that money still gets kicked back to me, right? So it's those, you know, particularly more traditionally research active universities have infrastructure in place where they're going out and selling your patent for you because they get a chunk of the revenue that's generated by it. Typically, the author gets some percentage and the department would get some percentage as well. Yeah.
So they also do a lot of the back end work that would cost you money.
That's right. So the Georgia Tech patent, I didn't pay a single dime for that. Right? They paid the lawyers. They paid the licensing fees. We'll get to in a minute. Same thing would happen here. I have a patent here. Right? UL paid the lawyers, the licensing fees, the application fees, all that stuff.
And then you got paid while you were doing it as well.
That's right. Salary. Yeah. So I'm getting paid salary the whole time. So most, you know, universities at least have a structure set up where it's in my interest to get patents and do inventive stuff. And then it's, I don't have to worry about paying for the patent. And as we'll see, I don't have to worry about paying lawyers to defend that patent either, if necessary. UL would pay for that, or, you know, Georgia Tech for my Georgia Tech one, or your company if you're working some other company. Yes, sir.
What about liability? Like if something would happen, something.
Same thing, same case, right? It's they own the IP, it's not mine. Right. Yeah.
That's
how about like for resume and stuff, could you say what you're involved in the patent?
Well, so even if they own the intellectual property, the way the law is structured, you are still listed as the inventor.
Okay.
Right. So you all owns the licensing rights to what my patent here. But it's me and a couple of my students that are listed as the inventors.
Okay, so I guess that's more like a skill.
Yeah, so the patent gets listed on my CV. I'm the inventor. They just happen to own the rights to sell it and license it to whoever might want to use it, if anybody. Yeah?
Is there any way for you to get the licensing rights?
Yeah, so that's the other piece of the puzzle that kind of ties in. Quite often, a university will say, well, I get first. A lot of places will offer to you first. Do you want to license it? You kind of get right of first refusal at a lot of places. Right. So I want to go start a company with my patent. UL is probably going to support that. If not financially, then by kind of friendly licensing terms. Right.
What is the benefit that they would in turn get out from it? Maybe just exposure?
Exposure is one. Like, shouldn't matter, but it does in terms of like university rankings. You know, schools care about that. That determines what kind of students we have coming here, how many students want to come here, right? That's ends up being important. So the kind of research measures, we'll look at number of papers are generated, number of patents are generated, how much research money, those kind of thing. If you have really important patents and really doing transformative research, the licensing can end up being a significant amount of money. It takes a while and takes a lot of effort for a university to get up to that level and have that type of patent and so most places are not operating there. It's kind of exposure. It's maybe trying to break even on licensing fees, improving university status, those kind of things. I saw another hand somewhere. Yes, sir.
Have you personally invented anything while working here?
Yeah, I have one patent that's been awarded already. I have another that's in processing right now. And like I said, I have the one for my Georgia Tech PhD stuff. We'll talk about what that procedure looks like. That's kind of a decent chunk of that, kind of what that process looks like in terms of doing that. Good questions before we go on. Let's keep rolling. There are a couple types of patents. Utility patents is kind of how things work. So as an engineer, more or less, if you're going to file a patent, it's going to be a utility patent. How does this thing work? How does this design work? In contrast, the design patents is kind of what it looks like. Okay, design in the kind of architecture and design, College of Architecture and Design type design. Like what's the shape of the car or something like that? It's a design patent. Okay. So let's talk primarily, we'll talk for the rest of the time largely about utility patents. Okay. So to get a patent, the US until pretty recently used to be what's called a first to invent system. So that's when the logbooks and your lab notebook really, really mattered. Because you had to be able to prove you were the first person to invent this, right? So you had to have evidence of conception of the idea, diligence in testing it, and then proof. And the reduction to practice is still an important part. Okay? Reduction to practice means it didn't just work this one time and has never worked since. Right? It's repeatable. It works all the time. Okay? It's reduction to practice. I can do this as many times as I want. I can make a million of these if I want, if I had the resources to do so. Right? Most other countries have been first to file. Meaning whoever filed for the patent first, doesn't matter who invented it first, whoever filed for the patent first is the qualified inventor. Okay? So we actually switched back in 2013 to first to file as well. Any guesses as to why?
It probably takes a lot of investigation.
Exactly right. That's was the driving factor here. Largely having to figure out who was actually the first person to invent it takes a lot of resources. The stamp on the submission, timestamp on the submission is a lot easier to process and determine who got it. There's also arguments. We'll see. There's some slides later that we'll kind of breeze through, but I keep in the presentation. Arguments for and against first to file versus first to invent. Right. In terms of which one favors individual inventor versus a big corporation, those kind of things. Okay. So that's kind of like how you qualify for a patent and what you need to do to kind of the timing and how it works out. What's the actual function of a patent? What does a patent do for you? Protects your intellectual property. How? Like, what is it doing for you? Allow you to capitalize on your design. Perhaps. I think the second part of that, what was the second part? The second part of that is what a patent does for you. Right. So he said, I might be able to capitalize on my design and other people can't copy it or that do that kind of thing. So what a patent actually gives you, doesn't give you any money, right? And in fact, most patents probably earn negative dollars by the time you've invested developing the IP and paying lawyers and such, right? So what a patent really does is give you the right to exclude someone else from using your intellectual property. That's what it does for you. Nothing more, nothing less. Okay? And furthermore, it's not a criminal offense for someone to copy your intellectual property. Okay? So it works out in civil court. You have to go to court and prove they're using your idea. Right? So it's not it's non-trivial to even enforce this right to exclude if you're an individual inventor just inventing stuff in your garage. Right? So this is the other place where, as a professor, UL helps me, or Georgia Tech, or whoever. Right? They are the ones that are going to do this. I don't have to worry about paying a lawyer to do that if someone's taking my idea. Question, or are you stretching?
So let's say somebody is using your design, right? But you
yeah.
have to prove about it.
Yep.
You couldn't stop it unless you somehow figure it out.
I couldn't stop
it.
You
have to investigate actively.
I have to know, yep. Using. That's right. So you hear these firms called patent trolls. These patent troll firms, they buy up all these different patents and just go looking for people to sue. Right? So they don't invent anything. They just buy up rights to patents and they look for people to sue, and that's their business model, is to try to win those lawsuits. Or quite often extort people out of money, to be quite blunt about it. We're going to sue you unless you pay us whatever dollars a month. Right. So that's that comes up. Okay. So it gives you the right to exclude. Okay. And, you know, like we said, the utility patents are about how stuff works, right? So it might be the machine itself. Here's the hardware of how this mechanism works. It could be the process. So my patents are process patents. What this is the control algorithm to do this certain thing. The ones I have are not, this is the mechanical design of something. Yes?
Could you get like a utility and design patent on like the same?
Yes. Option? Yeah. So the utility will cover how it works. The design would be how it looks. Okay. So that's what a patent does for us. What's the requirement to get a patent? What do I have to do? To file first, yeah, that's a good one. Somebody else said, I heard something.
Get avoided.
Get a lawyer, that's right. I think even before that, you want to think about these, though. Because that clock starts ticking. Dollars start going up real quick. Actually have a design. Has to be something new, okay? So that's a key thing, right? Has to be new. So before the filing date of your application, okay? You have to have something that's new. And new, in this case, means something very specific. Okay? New means that you haven't publicly disclosed that idea yet. Because if not, it's out in the open before you file your patent. It's not new anymore when you're filing your patent. Right? Can't be used or known. Right? So you can't take some idea that's being used all over the place and figure out nobody's patented this before and then try to get a patent for it. Right? So it can't be used or known. Okay? You can't be trying to sell it yet before you file for the patent. Because then by the time you file for the patent, it's not new. It's out in the open. It's known. Okay? Or otherwise commercially exported. You can't be using it in your business, for example, before you file for the patent. Okay? So these are kind of common ways, and we'll talk about some, if you have time, some kind of cases where people messed up really bad, cost themselves a bunch of money by doing one of these things. Okay? So it has to be new. That's one big requirement. What other requirements are there? Proof of a reduction to practice, sure. So you can't patent a perpetual motion machine. It doesn't work. It doesn't exist. So it has to have some functionality. The other thing, the other kind of other cases, it has to have utility, novelty, and non-obvious to a practitioner skilled in the field. Okay? These are the points that typically get fought over in lawsuits. Right? And these are the points you have to fight when you're trying to get a patent. Okay? The non-obvious one is sometimes hard. Okay? Oh, your work is just like these other four patents, and if a practitioner skilled in the art saw those three patents, they would get to the exact same conclusion you did. It's the obvious conclusion. Okay? You don't qualify for a patent in that case. So it has to be non-obvious to a practitioner skilled in the art. Okay? It has to have utility, and it has to be new. It has novelty. Okay? So given that, even given those things, most patents are typically for kind of evolutionary ideas. Right? It's just non-obvious steps on things that have come before. Okay? Or non-obvious combinations of things from different areas that might not be not the completely obvious extension of known stuff. Yes, sir?
So, like, on the infomercials and stuff, where they say patent pending on everything.
Patent pending, all that means is they filed the application. Yeah. Okay. So, given that, how can we lose patent rights? Kind of already talked through it, right? I can do some kind of public demonstration, go to an exhibition. If I have an idea and I want to eventually pursue a patent for it here, I can't present it at even an academic conference before I filed some information protecting me. Okay? I can't have public testing. Okay? So I have testing things out in the public. Right? That's the way to use it. I can't lose a patent if someone runs away with my intellectual property from my company and starts spreading it around. Okay? You might have other recourse in the civil court of law, you perhaps could sue them for loss in revenue from that patent, but you are not going to have that patent anymore. Okay? You start selling it, you also lose too. Yeah.
If you were to have somebody that knew about it, that was working around you or working with you, and you got them to sign a non-disclosure agreement, would that protect you from them running off?
So the non-disclosure agreements just give you the right to sue them, basically, if they go talk about it. It doesn't stop them from talking about it. So there was a case recently where it was the self-driving car stuff. So a guy that had worked at Google for a long time took stuff he learned at Google and the way they were doing it at Google and took and worked at Uber and brought all those ideas with him. So there's a, I think, ongoing lawsuit still about that. Oh, you're using stuff that you developed in Google and using our intellectual property and you just gave it to Uber. So imagine that's kind of a large lawsuit, right? And that stuff happens, and there's lawsuits sort that out. That's one way to lose it. Okay, some critical dates. Okay, again, in most countries, the U.S. being one, your application has to be filed before a public disclosure. We have a system, and it's pretty widely used around the world, is also that we have provisional patent applications. Okay, this is an application we'll talk more about. But basically, your clock, you're kind of planting your flag in the ground. I invented this on this date. And what you're basically saying is, hey, we're going to file a patent sometime in the next year for this idea. Right? So what you've done, kind of plant your flag, I'm the first to invent this. The provisional patent, you basically just have kind of 1 year of protection. You've said, hey, this is mine. I have something coming to you guys. At that point, you can sell and start talking to people. So that's quite often what happens. I have this idea. It's really great. I think I have all these customers. You would want to file a provisional and then go out and see if you really do have customers. Okay, is it worth paying all the lawyers and things to get the full patent? Okay, this guy is pretty simple to do and not expensive, really. Yeah?
Something like that, how much would it cost?
The provisional patent application is, I think, a couple hundred dollars. And that's one where you probably can do it yourself. They're pretty simple. Yeah.
Is there some kind of fee if you don't end up going through with the patent?
No. So if you don't go through within a year, it does become public at that point.
Okay.
Right. So if you don't file within that year, that idea can't be patented anymore. So that's kind of the trade-off there. Am I a year within really being able to file this? Right. You give up kind of 1 year. Right. That starts your clock 1 year earlier on your time of protection. You have 20 years of protection. Okay. So those are things you have to weigh on when you're going to file. And big companies have huge law offices effectively playing all these chess pieces for them. Yeah.
So you were talking about losing a patent. In the terms that we were talking about, would it be, I guess, for your case, in your best interest not to bring any of the work that you have in your patents at Georgia Tech to here? Would that somehow be a conflict, or do they have, is that kind of agreement that you all have?
So I think most universities are not going to have a problem with that unless I start to profit from it. If I'm selling that idea, if I start some company here, then yeah, Georgia Tech, right? But if I'm doing it in academic pursuit and extending that here, I think Georgia Tech and probably most universities would see that, oh, we're more likely to get licensure if this work keeps going forward of the original stuff. They still have the, if I want to patent stuff and I want to have a business that needs stuff beyond that, well, I'm going to need this original patent licensure anyway. So it's in their benefit for me to keep working on that stuff. Yeah.
Do you have to file after the 20 years again?
No, after 20 years, we're almost there. After that, after the patent expires, it's done. It's public domain at that point. So if you've used CVS or Target or Walmart brand Tylenol, right, that's because the patent on that formula has expired. So that formula now is public domain. Anybody can use that. And that's the fundamental purpose of the patent kind of process. And the kind of core idea is that we'll give you protection for some amount of time, but then we want everybody to benefit from this as easily as possible. So we'll let you recoup your costs, hopefully, of development. But then after that time is up, anybody can use that idea. They're free to go. Right? And that's kind of that's the driving idea in theory from the patent system. Yeah. You get a new start, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so we'll talk about the provisional patent. So really, there's even a step before this provisional patent application. And it happens, we have to do these here. Most companies have these as well. Some places you'll get measured by how many of these you do a year. Okay, there's an invention disclosure. And basically what this is, and here's the link to ours here at UL, is basically you're telling your company or the university, I have this idea, I think it's worth us patenting. It's worth us pursuing and getting a patent for. And you write up, it's kind of an internal kind of application, some paperwork, And then they kind of make a decision, is it worth our investment to pursue this patent? And generally then, they say no, then they will quite often offer you, okay, you can take it and patent it on your own if you want. Right? So that's that will play out in a lot of places. I have this invention, I think it's worth filing. That's this paperwork. It's almost always called an invention disclosure. That, whoever decides that, your company or your organization says yes or no. And then quite often we'll say, okay, you can go forward with it if you want, but you're footing the bill and everything. Then there's that provisional patent application, right? There's a one-year life, like we said. For most foreign international patents, you have 30 months from that first file. So if you want protection abroad, things get a little bit more complicated. If you want international protection, that's when having good lawyers tends to help. The thing about this, like we said, it never issues as a patent. So it being a provisional patent application, it's kind of a completely separate thing, right? It's not... It doesn't roll over into a patent application if you pay some extra fee after the year or something like that. You have to submit still a full separate patent application within that one-year time frame. Okay. The thing that is important about that is what's contained in that provisional patent must be enabling for the patent application. Meaning, this kind of language, what this means is that you can't have a provisional patent application to get your time in the sand. And then the invention completely changes in that year. Some completely different invention that you're going to file for. Right? So what you file the patent for underneath this provisional has to be enabling. So what the contents of that patent application have to be here. That one clear? Okay. So that kind of prevents people from, oh, I know Joe has an invention coming out. I'm going to file something. And then I'm going to have a year to figure out how he was doing it. And file my full application now. So it has to be enabling. Okay. And then, like you might imagine, pretty much everything in this class is an iterative process. You want to, you know, quote unquote, spoon feed the patent attorney about your idea. You're going to know your idea better than your attorney can. Most patent attorneys do have technical backgrounds, actually. So a huge number of them would have done engineering as an undergraduate and then went to law school. One of my former students, research students, did that recently. Right. So they will have some technical expertise, but not of your invention, and not necessarily expertise in your sub-genre of engineering, necessarily. Okay. And like your reports in here, you know, figures, plots, drawings, all those kind of things are super important to communicate that information to your lawyer, and then get communicated as part of the patent application to the patent examiner as well. Okay. U.S. patent application has an abstract, very much like the ones you write from the report. It's a one summary and one paragraph summary of your invention. Okay. It has some, what the section is called, background of the invention. That works out to be a lot like your introduction. Here's the problem being solved. Here's the ways other people have tried to solve it. Okay. And then quite often why those things are deficient and what we're solving in this case. Then you'll have a summary of the invention, very much like section 2 of the report you have due on Monday. Here's the actual invention. Here's the design. Here's the concept and how it works. Okay. One thing that is different from your reports, in patent applications, you have a completely separate section that just goes and describes each figure. Just kind of lists them by bullet point. Figure 1 is blah, blah, blah. Figure 2 is blah, blah. Figure 3 is it. So it's completely separate from the description. Those figures also get cited up in the summary. But they have the description of those drawings and figures as a completely separate section in these patent applications. Then the drawings themselves, right? You have a section that's called Description of Preferred Embodiments. Okay? This is, oh, here's my invention. Here's the algorithm that I'm proposing for this controller. Here are all the different ways it could be used. Here's this mechanism I'm proposing. Here are the ways it could be used or manufactured or different variations of it. Okay? So how could this idea be implemented effectively? And what are the preferred ways of doing it, the recommended ways of doing that? Okay? And then you have a section called claims, and I have that in all caps because basically the entire document is there to support those claims. The claims is where you say, this is what the invention is. This is what it's about. This is what I want protected. All this stuff in this case is up to supporting those. Okay, you have major claims and minor claims. We'll look at an example patent in just a minute. Okay. So this shakes out a lot like what you're doing. All the same content is there. It gets shuffled around a little bit for some of the kind of legal reasons, but the content and you guys' design reports is basically here. The timeline takes a long time. So, the provisional patent application, you have 12 months in order to file the full application. Right? During that time, you can keep developing, but remember, everything that you develop in that year has to have been enabled by the provisional patent application. So your design can get better, you can try to understand the process better, you can expand your idea, but it has to have been enabled by what's in the provisional. Okay? After you file your application, generally 8 to 14 months, you could maybe say a year, you get what's called a U.S. Patent Office action. So they'll say, almost never, yes, we approve. Oh, we found this prior art that looks like your invention. Tell us why it's different. Tell us how what you're doing is different. We found these three patents, and we think this is obvious to someone skilled in the art, your extension. Why is it not obvious? Oh, it doesn't seem like what you invented has a lot of utility. Explain why this is actually useful. Right. So there's almost always that. Okay? In that loop, they'll typically give you 1 to 6 months to respond, depending on the kind of severity of that response, if you will. And then you submit it to them, and of course they probably have some other action after that. So you can get stuck in that loop for quite a while. I think the patent I have at Georgia Tech, we went back and forth 3 or 4 times. In this loop. The one I have here was a bit quicker, but not much. Okay? And then eventually you hope to get to an action that says, yes, we will accept this as a patent. Okay? And typically the patent has changed a little bit. Right? So some of the claims will accept claims 1 to 3, but claims 4 and 5, those are covered by these other previous patents. You can't include those. Right? So that's kind of the process going through. Or what you're claiming is way too broad, you have to narrow your claims down to a tighter domain, is another kind of common action. Okay. Typically, you have a kind of 1 to 3 month timeline to the allowance of the patent, you have to pay the fee, and then the patent finally issues. So this can be quite a long process. Okay. So if you look at the numbers I have there, it's just like 26 to 44 months. It takes a long time. You can put patent pending on your stuff while you're doing this. You could be selling this whole time, right? You could be selling this whole time and, you know, maybe you never get a patent for it, but you recoup your cost of development selling during that 4 years or whatever. Right. Someone asked about costs. These are really rough. The big part is this one. Right, these initial searches, you could do some of this your own and save money in terms of searching for existing art, prior art. Right, that's going to be the first thing the law office at your company organization probably does, IP office. Here's an invention Dr. Vaughn brought. Okay, what's similar? And they have databases to search for similar terms and things like that. Are there existing patents? The USPTO actually has a pretty good website. You can search for patents. Google Scholar will also search for patents if you check a little box on the side. So it's pretty easy to get to prior art for stuff if you're looking around. So the biggest cost are these last couple. It takes a lot of time, as you saw, and therefore money to actually get the patent approved. And then, like we've talked, if you actually have to prosecute that patent, that gets really, really expensive. Okay. So for a patent, we said the invention is public domain. Design patents are 14 years, utility patents are 20 from the earliest effective filing date. So when we say that you kind of lose a year of protection if you file a provisional, that's what we mean. Like it doesn't go from the full patent filing date any longer, it goes from the provisional filing date. So your timeline kind of starts 1 year earlier if you do a provisional. Okay. You are protected during that year though. So there's some trade-off there depending on what you want to do. Okay. Let's look at some example patent claims. So, here is one set of examples. This would be claim 1 for this particular patent. Okay, I'll let you maybe take a read of it, or skim it at least. for vibration control method. So the crane stuff I showed you is largely an extension of this. Showed you like one of the first days of class. Largely an extension of this patent. So you would have a claim one that's list out these things. We're going to do these things. This is how we're going to do it. And then you have these kind of minor claims or secondary claims. Is, hey, just like claim one, but we do this little part different. Just like claim one, but this little part's different. Those are kind of minor claims. Okay, so if a major claim, that's the main method, and then you can have a bunch of minor claims that are do it like this, but tweak that part. Do it like that, but tweak this section. Yeah?
Like for running your R papers, what's the kind of detail you have to go into for these claims? Like, because I say you say like dynamics a lot, like unwanted dynamics.
Yeah.
You don't have to go any further than that. They can explain yourself in a paper, in the previous.
So, the question was, how broad can this language be? And that's quite often what you end up going back and forth with the patent office about. As a writer of this patent, I want this to be as broad as possible because it covers all kinds of different cases, right? So that's quite often what they'll say is, oh, you can't, unwanted dynamics is too broad. You have to say unwanted system oscillation. So it only means vibratory systems now. So that's one thing where you end up going back and forth with the patent office quite often. As you want to start, you want this to be as broad as possible as an inventor. So you get protection over a large area. The patent office probably wants you to have it as small as possible. So there's some back and forth there that you get to kind of fight about, basically. This idea, I think it's an old video, but well, maybe I'll show you. This is actually a patent from, I think, 1994, maybe. And I'll show this video because I want to talk about this company in a second. This idea, this patent's for an idea called input shaping we still use in my lab. A lot of my PhD work was based around. So basically, this company has this idea, if you remember the crane videos from the first day of lecture. Right? So the idea is basically I'm going to take some user's input to my flexible system, crane. The actual example from this video is the arm that was part of the shuttle, space shuttle. So it's called the Canada arm. Huge extended reach arm. You imagine I reach out really far, I get a lot of vibration. So I can use this idea as I'm trying to control that arm to limit that vibration and have better control. So the patent of that guy, of that idea, looks like this. So this patent, this particular patent, 100 pages, had 60 figures, 130 claims, and my advisor was actually a co-inventor on this, the lead inventor, Singho's there. My PhD advisor, he said it took him 3 or 4 months to write. And they said they wrote most of it themselves and had that letter, the lawyer basically edited and put it kind of in the bulletin. So it's a huge amount of work went into getting this patent. Okay? And the claims you saw are from this guy, the ones you saw on your slide. So paragraph abstract. You see also what's listed in these, kind of once they're finalized, you get the date of filing, you get kind of what area did the patent office search in for similar patents is always reported. Okay, what other patents are cited as possibly prior art within this one? You get the names of the patent officer who looked at it as part of that patent as well. And then the law firm that's representing the inventor is always listed as well. So you get a lot of information about the process from this title page of the patent. Okay. So this particular small company, the company I was trying to show the video of was called Convolve. I'm not sure they exactly still exist. So my PhD advisor and some of his fellow grad students at MIT came up with this idea along with their PhD advisor and spun off a company. So kind of like we're talking about, they did the invention. MIT owned the intellectual property, but MIT licenses it to them. They can spin off their company. That's MIT wants that. We would want that here. Okay? They start this company, they're selling this vibration idea, they got it on the space shuttle, did some other stuff with NASA. They did some work for Compaq, old computer company that doesn't exist anymore, and Seagate, hard drive. And the work they did was for this mechanism that actually tested the old spinning platter type hard drives, not the solid state ones, right? So this is some time ago. So testing these hard drives. And the testing apparatus had vibration, so they used this idea to get rid of vibration and be able to speed up and have more reliable testing of the hard drives. So they did that, and they did a good job, and said, well, okay, hey, Seagate, we can actually put this on the hard drive itself. right? So the rehab of one of those spinning platter hard drives, it looks like an old record player effectively, right? So any little vibration of that read head slows down how quickly I'm able to read the data off of the spinning platter, right? So nanoseconds every read adds up when you're making millions of reads every minute or second, right? So even saving a little bit of time helped a lot. So Seagate says, hey, that's really great. You guys did a good job, but no, thank you. We don't want to do that. What do you guys think happened? They did it anyway, right? So the company, little company Convolve, sued Seagate and Compaq for $800 million. Okay. What's the calculation that Seagate's making? Was that? Well, so that's kind of where this number might come from. Hey, our company, if you license this from us, we could have made this much money.
So isn't that they looked at how much money they could make off of the product, how much money they would have had to pay him, and how much money they would have had to pay to fight this in court, and figured that the court would be the cheapest route?
Court might be the cheapest route. And maybe even more likely, this little small company is no way they can afford the lawyers to fight us on this patent. Right, we're a huge company. We have an entire building of our campus probably dedicated to lawyers working for us. This little five-person startup company, there's no way they can stand up to us. Right, and this happens. It's not uncommon for situations like this to happen. Not good, but it just happens. Right. So when I say that the value of a patent is really about being able to exclude others, and that's only a value if you have the resources to be able to exclude others via lawsuits, et cetera. So what this company did, the primary founder, he went out and got investors in the lawsuit. They were basically betting on them winning this lawsuit and taking some chunk of the revenue if they won.
Did they win?
So here's the initial report of that lawsuit. So they get some money. Okay, I forget the number in this slide. 135. That's section 135, not a dollar sign, actually. So they got a little bit of money here, and it ends up getting settled kind of in pieces. It's all, you're violating this claim, you're violating that claim, you violated this claim doing that product, the same claim on this other product, those all get divided out typically. Because you have to prove kind of each one if it's your patent they hold. So this kind of happened 2008. 2009, this is actually from the New York Times. So this guy at Seagate came out and said, hey, we actually did this. We knowingly violated this patent. Okay, that ends up being a big deal, typically in the monetary part of that settlement, if there is a settlement. Not that we accidentally infringed upon this idea. We knowingly did it. The damages typically go way up if you can show that. Okay. So there he is, this guy Paul Galloway. Took it from Convolve. Then we look sometime later, 2011, and in this particular piece of it, they end up with Dell, who had bought part of one of the companies that had stolen this. It was a conglomerate. Dell owes $1.5 million. Some of it ended up at Western Digital. They owe $2.5. Hitachi owes $1.4. Not a ton of money in the big scheme of things. You're fighting a lawsuit for 8 years, 9 years. Okay. Again, this is just one piece of it, but that's a lot of effort. This company basically stopped doing any kind of engineering. This patent lawsuit took their whole effort, more or less, which is kind of, I think, the bigger cost of all this, probably. So the lesson there is, yeah, you want to get patents. It's nice to have intellectual property and have that line on your resume, but they're not really worth a whole lot unless you have the ability to protect them. So we'll talk really quickly. We'll just kind of brief over this really quickly. So 2011, there was this new law that changed us to first to file, and we have that 1 year public disclosure window. So that was something new as well with that. It also allows filing by someone other than the inventor. You used to have to file your own paperwork. Now your lawyer can file it on your behalf, which seems like a win to me. And then what's an interesting thing about this is now there's this period of time where a third party, not the patent office, anybody can look at that patent and say, oh, you missed this piece of prior art. That shouldn't have been a patent. There's this kind of time window after issuance. So there's a 9-month window that you can challenge. You see a patent's issued, you can challenge that within 9 months and get that issuance removed. Okay. So for example, that's kind of some people seem to have as a hobby. On the Stack Exchange kind of subboard, that people just discuss patents. Hey, this just issued, what do you guys think, et cetera, et cetera. Kind of interesting to follow some of it. So this is kind of an interesting one. The patent office kind of unloading some of their responsibility onto the public in some ways. Right. I'll just flash that up. If you wanted to read it, it's there. That's the first inventor stuff. Okay. Let's talk about that for just a second. I'm kind of curious what you guys think. So if I'm going to argue for first to invent our old system, what are the advantages of that first to invent system? What's that? What about it? Made it, I earn it? How about I file first, I own it? That seems more... Okay, sure. Okay. Okay. So I think both of you guys in some ways are arguing it's kind of more fair in some way that the person who actually invented it is who's going to get the patent. Doesn't matter who filed it first. They're probably on board with that maybe. What's that? What's your... Yeah, so that's actually, I think, an argument for this one, right? So I can, if I have first invent, right, I know I'm still protected even if I haven't filed this patent yet. So I may be able to spend some time getting my resources together to actually file the patent and still be able to show I invented it at some date earlier, right? So there's kind of the argument that it favors maybe the individual inventor over the company is one argument kind of for this in that direction. That I might have to save money for a year before I can even start filing, whereas a company could just file whenever they get it done, right? So that there's kind of the argument that this first to invent system favored the individual inventor. Right? What are the arguments for that first to file system, our new system, and then what most of the world's been for a while now? It's quicker. Yeah, so it's basically administrative simplicity. Right, so it's much easier to prove how I was the first one to file this thing than I was the first one to invent it. Okay, the other one, in the broader sense of that patent system, remember the kind of overarching ideal of the patent system is to get stuff into the public domain. Let the inventor make some money off of it, protect it for a while, but then get it to where anyone can use it. Okay, so that's one of the other major arguments kind of for first to file is this kind of incentive to file as soon as you get it done and it it qualifies as an invention, which means it's going to get into the public domain sooner. Then, as an individual inventor, I'm going to sit on it for a little while and then file my patent sometime later. So actually, we have some empirical data. There's probably some coming out by now for the U.S., but Canada switched relatively recently. There's this kind of paper that shows kind of frequent number of applications and things like that. We'll just skim through that data. You can take a look if you want or look at that patent. And then you kind of look at individual inventor share. So it kind of goes down after they switch to first to file. So kind of support of some of the things we said. So can do that. Okay, let's talk for a little bit about what makes a patent valuable. What makes a patent valuable? So I can exclude people, right? But what calculation is your company or organization going to make to try to determine whether they want to pay for the lawyers and fees to actually get the patent? How much they could charge for it. Yeah, I mean, that's the calculation, right? Am I going to make more money off of this than it cost me to file for it? That's the first calculation. Yeah?
It solves some problem that could benefit them, or at least something that was costly.
Sure. So we're talking about, in that case, maybe generation of revenue straight for the company, or you know, kind of indirect revenue generation by making company processes more efficient or something like that, right? You can also use, for example, your patent portfolio as a small business to help you as collateral on loans. Okay? Patents also give you a way, perhaps, to attract investors. Right, I have this patent portfolio in my little small startup company. Look, no, Google can't go and do this. I own the patent of it. Right, that's attractive to an investor. Okay. You also look, is that here? Yeah, there we go. Many, many places also have research and development tax credits for small companies that are quite often based upon what your intellectual property holdings are. I have this small business. It's going to be a viable small business because nobody can steal my ideas. That's some support of that. Right, so you might qualify for some tax credits or tax relief in that sense as well. Okay. So there are multiple ways to use your patent portfolio. Okay. So you'll see this all the time. Google and Apple and Samsung have been at this for a while. Apple and Qualcomm are at this right now. The Google versus Uber thing, I think, eventually settled this way. That basically, oh, you're violating my patent? Oh, yeah. I'm violating your patent? Yeah, you're violating mine, too. Here, look. Right? So it goes back and forth like that. So, okay, let's just drop it all. We're fine for now. Okay, we won't sue you guys if you don't sue us. Right, so it's kind of that back and forth, kind of bargaining that way. You'll see a lot, particularly large companies, will patent things, right? Even if they have no intention of making a product or selling it, right? For numerous reasons. I can prevent other people from selling that and making money. So again, big companies do this all the time. I'm going to patent this thing, and we have no intention of actually ever making that a product. But we want to compete. We want to prevent our competitor from making a product too, so we can patent that. Or if they want to make it a product, we want them to have to pay us in order to make it, right? Similarly, it also patenting, and you know, again, big companies tend to do this, patent things kind of all around their main business, so that anyone trying to enter that area now has to license all that ancillary stuff from them in order to be able to even enter their business at all and compete. Right. So even if it's stuff that's not directly use of my products, if I kind of lay all these landmines around my business effectively, so anyone's trying to come to compete against me has to go through this minefield of my patent portfolio. That's, you know, that's business in some ways. Yeah, you have a question?
I was kind of thinking more of like, let's say you said like this is, the patent is like a right to exclude people. So you can let some people in, right? You can let some people use it,
yeah,
if you choose.
Yeah.
So like if you have, let's say you're starting another business or something and you already,
yeah,
have a bigger business or something, you can like protect it.
Yes.
Else.
That's right. Exactly right. So those big kind of conglomerate type companies like GE and those kind of companies that have all kinds of, you know, thousands of different little businesses, that's very common how they work. There's some GE intellectual property will let our spin-off business that still has GE as a parent company but kind of operates separately, will let you use this for free or whatever. Okay. So basically, you know, that defensive use can also become offensive, is let people violate and then go after them once you see they're violating. And then basically, you know, we can derive revenue in terms of that. And then we can exploit, you know, those patents. Even if we don't have any idea or any plan to make products here or there, we can still get revenue from those business areas by licensing those ideas to other people. Okay. And like I mentioned, there are companies, entire companies that exist to do kind of this, right? Just buy up patents that they see and go out and look for people to sue. As you might imagine, things that make patents valuable, or, you know, basically if I have a major technology, and particularly a major technology that has very little prior art. So if it is something that's kind of really, really new, in other words, okay? So if there's very little prior art, what that lets you do is write your claims very broadly. So then your patent applies in a lot of different industries and a lot of different places. It becomes a really valuable patent in that sense. And like we said, you can also set up as a, you know, those patents that become landmines. Everyone has to come through this patent if they want to enter this industry. That becomes a really valuable patent. Right? Because everyone that's coming into our industry has to license that from us now. And of course, if there's widespread applications, that's valuable. So these are kind of common sense ways that patents become valuable. Okay? Questions about patents? Okay. Oh, sorry.
Mm-hmm. And it would be really valuable. So you try to file for the patent and everything, and then you try to get investors to help you like pay for all the stuff that you'd have to pay for and everything and start your company.
So I think that falls back a little bit, like I'm trying to sign NDAs. Right. So if you're trying to have those investors come on board before you filed, I think what you probably would want to do is make sure you file the provisional first. Right. So you're kind of protected then. You put your flag in the ground. I'm the inventor. This is mine. But then you would want some kind of contractual obligation of whoever you're coming to invest. So that, yes, you could sue them, but you would hopefully have that contract written in a way where it was kind of obvious that you were going to win. So that's kind of how those things tend to go. Other patent questions? Okay. Copyrights, another way you can protect intellectual property. And basically, the origins of copyrights are protect creative works. So writing, art, music. Okay. So one kind of interesting thing is that while the computer algorithm is a utility patent, the actual code itself could be copyrighted. Like exactly how it's written, just like a book can be copyrighted. It's kind of an interesting thing. And just like a patent, it basically excludes others from producing the same thing as you. Okay. One major difference is the term is way longer and gets longer kind of all the time. All right. So basically you have 70 years from creation plus the life of the last living author. So that's a long time for a song or whatever to be protected. Or 95 years for things that are developed by corporations. And this has gotten longer. I think it's still 95, but it tends to grow. Disney has a lot of money, and they lobby for that to get extended. They don't want Mickey Mouse to be public domain, right? Similarly, you know, Warner Brothers, those kind of companies tend to fight. We want this to be longer, right? And again, the copyrights are for kind of the creative works. So like we said, for the software, there's no protection of function, right? So functionality, if you copyright your source code, the actual how what that source code does is not protected by the copyright. Just that exact wording of the code. Right? You would need a patent to cover, utility patent to cover the functionality. Okay. Last one we'll talk about is a trade secret. Okay. What do you guys think a trade secret is? There's an official legal definition, but what do you think a trade secret is? Just casually.
Probably like internal information.
Yeah, this is essential to our business. We have cool ideas and algorithms and stuff, and we're just not going to tell anybody about them. All right. So legally, it's information that derives economic value from the fact that it's not known to the public and blah, blah, blah. Right, there's a legal definition of a trade secret. So you can protect trade secrets with NDAs, provisions of employment agreements, things like that. Okay. You also can lose them kind of easier. Right? So you're not protected if someone comes in and reverse engineers your method without internal knowledge of it. So if I see what your company's doing and you don't have a patent, but I figure out how you're doing it and I just do it, I'm fine then. Magic trick, a trade secret.
They're like super secretive about it.
Yeah, it's the culture of being a magician. If I was able to make the case that the entire economic value of my act is based upon the secret of that particular trick being unknown, yeah. Might have a case. Right? So I'm not covered if that happens, if I have just a trade secret. If someone figures out how I'm doing something and starts doing it on their own, I have no recourse in that sense. Okay. The thing that's a little bit different about a trade secret is that theft of those trade secrets does carry criminal penalties. If you can prove your company was taking steps to keep this thing a secret, it was known to the employee, for example. Where is that? Here. Known to the employee, that this was supposed to be a company secret and they leak it out, then you do have some recourse in that sense. That's right. That's right. So what do you guys think maybe the most lucrative trade secret is? Arguably, I guess. Secret recipe. What? Which one?
KFC.
KFC? I think there's one worth more than KFC, actually.
Chick-fil-A?
There's one worth more than that, I think.
Cane sauce.
Cane sauce? Maybe. There's one even bigger than all those. Yeah, yeah. Somebody said it. Like Daniels? Coke, yeah. Coke actually is yeah, you don't want that one. So yeah, Coke is actually is arguably, you know, in most people's account, the most valuable trade secret there. It's not patented. Right? It's not, there's no copyright on it. It's just a trade, it's just a secret within Coke. Right? And that's why it's still protected, because if they had patented it when it came out, that protection has expired, and now everyone can produce exactly Coke. Right? And it's a trade secret, so there's no penalty for me trying to copy Coke and selling blah, 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 cola with a K. Yeah. Right? So it's a trade secret. And actually, if you've been to the Coke Museum in Atlanta, which is actually kind of a cool place to visit, they make a big show of it being a secret. They have, here's the recipe, it's in this big vault and stuff. So, trade secrets can be useful depending on what you're working on. Questions about any of that? Yes, sir.
So how would you want to know if it's good to either file a patent or keep something a trade secret?
How you decide which one of these ways is appropriate to protect your intellectual property is the more general question. I think technology stuff as a trade secret, I think you have to think about the kind of shelf life of that technology, if you will. Right? So a lot of what we do, a lot of what's going to be applicable for a patent or would be valuable as a secret might not necessarily have value beyond the 20 years of the patent anyway. So you have to make that calculation. Is it better for us just to try to keep it in case it lasts, this has effect and is useful after 20 years, or is it better for us to get the patent and perhaps license, and can we get more revenue that way if you're concerned primarily about revenue? So there's a lot that probably goes into that equation in each circumstance, trying to estimate your market, what's the longevity of that market. There's a lot that it depends. All right. Yes, sir. Right, so that's the other thing. Do I think I could even get a patent on this idea? Maybe not. I don't know. Right. Or if it's a trade secret, is it something that once people see how to do, and I'm selling as a product even though it's a trade secret, could they easily figure out what I was doing? In that case, you probably want to fall back and get a patent. Because then if you can. Right. So all those things, it's a big, long cost function you have to figure out, not optimization problem. Other questions? Okay, so I'll include these in the slide. There's some information about some inventors, sob stories, kind of winning IP stories, and then, one too many, some links of interest. I think these were kind of interesting article. It's a nice paper about the cost of those patent trolls I talked about. Things like that if you're interested in any of this. Big takeaway lessons: know the IP policy of who you're working for or working with, right? Be protective, don't release stuff, don't lose a patent for going to some exhibition or something before you file your information. Okay. And then most patents, you saw how much they cost to get probably. Most patents don't make any money on average, I would say. So, and as a result, most patents probably lose money because you had to pay to get it. So you need to make that calculation for your work as necessary. Yeah.
Just a quick question. If you say came up with something while you were working for a company, but you didn't tell anybody about it and don't work for the company anymore several years later, is it still yours or is it?
If I have an idea and I developed the idea while I was working at the company.
Maybe not develop,
Well, just the idea is not enough. Remember that, though. Yeah, it has to be reduction to practice. So the idea, I think we could do it this way. That's not enough to get a patent anyway. You need that reduction to practice bit, right, to be able to apply and actually get a patent. So you had the idea, and it was reduced to practice while you were in their employ, but you didn't file it until sometime later. I think they probably would have an argument, particularly if it was valuable, they might deem it's not worth it. Depends on the patent. A particularly valuable patent, they're probably going to say, hey, he invented that here. We should have co-inventorship on that patent or co-IP ownership. So give us 5% and we'll leave you alone. That's probably how it would go if you're making a bunch of money. Or give us 30% or whatever. Right. Other questions? All right. Hopefully see some of you in open lab hours this weekend.